Good morning. I'm Lisa Boleg. I'm going to get started in the interest of time. I am an associate professor in the School of Public Health at Drexel University in Philadelphia. And what I'm going to be doing today is, actually, you're going to see me twice. I'm going to be talking about some research that I've conducted in with a fabulous team of researchers in Philadelphia with black heterosexual men. Black heterosexual men are really sort of the missing link and have been quite invisible in theory, research, and interventions. This quote, an uphill battle every day, really sort of encapsulates what the men in this study talk about in terms of the structural context of their lives. No relationships to disclose. So also what I really want to get to is to show you sort of this conceptual model where we're trying to say to link structural factors with HIV risk. This slide just shows the prevalence of HIV among black men. In terms of heterosexual risk, the rates are very low for men. The virus is much more efficiently transmitted from men to women. But if you look in the first column, you'll see that even though high-risk heterosexual contact accounts for 8% of cases among men, black men account for 64% of those cases. But there's a way that the media and, sometimes even researchers, we've gotten sort of distracted by the sexiness of the down low and have spent so much attention on that, and that's really been a distraction. In my opinion, and an increasing number of scholars are now advocating for, look, we need to look at heterosexual men and how this virus is transmitted. All right, so this is a three-year study. It was funded by NIH, particularly NICHD at NIH, and we wanted to look at how structural factors, and so we're talking about poverty, incarceration, unemployment, things like that, were related with a gender role norm, so men's ideas of what it meant to be a man, sexual scripts, and what these could tell us about HIV risk. And we asked a whole lot of other things too, but for purposes of this presentation, I'm just going to focus on the structural factors. And we did it in two phases. In the first phase, we did focus groups and interviews because we really wanted to get the sort of culturally grounded understanding of the men's lives. And then we did a second phase that we just completed in July, where we collected data from 581 men who came and completed a computer survey. And so we were like right in the trenches in terms of getting ready to do the analyses of those. So to participate, men had to be black, African-American. They had to report having sex with a woman in the last 6 months between the ages of 18 to 44, lived in Philadelphia. Most of them, all of them actually, identified as heterosexual. And we had teams of recruiters who went out throughout Philadelphia and recruited men. And I don't have time to get into the sort of intricacies of the recruitment plan. And we had a $50 cash incentive. This tells a little bit of a sample, and so what I'm focusing on here are the in-depth interviews that we did with 30 of the men. And as you can see, some of the things that are most striking on this are the unemployment status. So of the 30 men, 16 of them were unemployed. You'll see that seven of the men had some high school, 43%, 13 of them were high school graduates. But if we go back up to income, you see this is a very low-income sample, with half of the 30 men reporting incomes of less than $10,000 a year. All right, so we interviewed them, and we really just, our interview questions asked people, sort of one of the first questions is, what's it like to be a black man? Tell me about your life as a black man. And based on our analyses, we sort of pulled out these sort of five themes that men talked about most, and I'm just going to give you a snapshot of what they said. So one, unemployment. Over and over and over again, men are talking about the stress of unemployment. And that, of course, is linked to number two, which is incarceration, where many of the men talked about being incarcerated, and that's linked to unemployment because if you have an incarceration history, chances are you're not going to be able to get a job. And so men talked about the experience of paying now for crimes that they did 13 or 14 years ago in terms of not being able to get a job. Racial microaggressions, so sort of racism. And so men also talked about sort of racism in their lives, and we sort of analyzed all these different ways they talked about racism, interpersonal racism, institutional racism. And the men also talked a lot about the stress of the streets and just what it's like trying to survive the streets in terms of drugs or violence in their neighborhood. And of course, related to racism, is police surveillance and harassment. The men talked about just the sense of always being a target. And now I'm going to share with you, might be hard for you to see some of the quotes, but I'll read them for you. So unemployment, here's an example, and Tony, and these are all pseudonyms. What Tony, who's 22, talked about being unemployed. He says, I'm unemployed right now, but I've been going on job interviews. You know, my resume is crazy. And what he meant by that is in terms of having all the qualifications to get a job. But every time I go to an interview, you know, it seems good, but I'm not getting no calls back or nothing like that. Like, I wouldn't be able to go to a job interview maybe with my goatee hanging like this. So I think if maybe I was another race, it would be cool. I think the point I want to stress here is that, you know, when the men in the study were talking about unemployment, they weren't talking about it within the context of this sort of contemporary recession that we're talking about. We're talking about sort of a history of chronic unemployment. And if you look at W.E. Du Bois's research about black people in Philadelphia, in 1899, Du Bois is writing about the sort of chronic unemployment of the Negro. And so, you know, it was really sort of quite striking to be reading sort of the same narratives years later. Incarceration. Here's an example from Rob, who's 40. Right now, there's a lot of stress and pressure on me, you know, not working and stuff like that. I'm still trying to find a job because I've been arrested a while ago, had a conviction on me, and it seems like every time I get laid off after 6 or 3 months, I'm getting laid off because of something that happened 13 or 14 years ago. So again, you know, sort of the stress of this experience. Over and over about the cops in Philadelphia. I'm a black man, and by the cops, I feel like I'm a target. Just recently walking down the street, the cops ride up. I was just walking regularly. You know, I'm just there. They look and give me the one over as though I'm a suspect or something. And it happens over and over again. You know what I mean? Just getting the one over, just being harassed by cops, always looking like I'm suspicious, like a suspect or something. Like you're always a target. Here's an example, and this is where we got the quote about an uphill battle, racial microaggressions. He described his life, Donovan, as an uphill battle every day for the simple fact of the racial disparities that we go through. Institutionalized racism in the work area, school, all of the different partitions that's put up, and all of the things that we have to go through just to survive every day as a black man is hard work. And this was over and over. So, you know, if you think about how stress has been sort of conceptualized in a lot of the social psychology literature, a lot of that sort of daily stress is about, you know, if you miss the bus, you miss the plane, that kind of thing. These men are talking about the sort of really mundane, everyday, searing stress related to these factors. And stress of the streets. Me as a black man, this is Justin who's 19. All right, I'm trying to survive the streets like crazy, man. Every time you turn around, somebody gets shot or something. It's hard to grow up in the streets now. You've got to be careful who you talk to, who you be around, the neighborhood that you live in. So it's crazy. So, you know, you get the sense of like almost like people talking about it sort of in living in trauma in a war zone of always having to be on guard. So we started wondering, like, okay, so how is this related then to, how might these structural factors be related to risk? And here our work is informed by Rafael Diaz's work with Latino gay men and gay and bisexual men, where he found that men who had more experiences with financial hardships, more experiences with homophobia, more experiences with racism, that they engaged in higher levels of risk. And what he theorized is that it's operating through sort of psychological distress. And that distress sort of constrains the ability of the individual to take steps to protect themselves, him or himself, from risk. So we're sort of looking at sort of two risk factors. One, psychological distress. And like, what is the impact of all of this stuff, you know, from the outside? And this is Malcolm, and he says, you know, like, I ain't gonna front, like, I almost killed myself before. Why? And, you know, he almost goes into this sort of alliteration, stress, everything, stress, women, stress, bills, stress. And we're also looking at gender role strain, right? So what happens if there are these sort of, norms about what it means to be a man in society, and you can't fulfill them? And that's sort of related to the presentation that's coming. You know, some have theorized that it sort of creates a sort of fragmented masculinity ideology, or just becomes another area of stress. And so here's Rob, and he's the same one who talked about being incarcerated, not getting a job, and he speaks quite eloquently about what it's like for him. He says, sometimes I feel like, you know, I'm letting my family down, you know, like I'm not, you know, holding up the part of my end of the bargain. Supposed to be there for my wife, you know, she ain't supposed to be out there struggling all the time and all the other stuff, you know, and it's hard when I'm focused and trying to, you know, get through this. So what we're trying to do, and this is one of the models we're going to test now that we have the quantitative data with 581 men, is to test this model and to see how these might be linked. So in the first box, we have the structural factors that I've just presented. In the middle, we're looking to see whether psychological risk factors mediate the relationship between these sort of structural factors and sexual risk. But we're also interested in exploring resilience as a moderator. Clearly, not all black men, not even all low-income black men, are engaging in risk. And so what are those factors that are protective for them? And some of the things that we're going to be looking at are social support, religiosity, spirituality, and coping. And so I hope to be back next year to present the findings of our test of this model. All right, so just in wrapping up, just a few implications. One is, obviously, this need to integrate structural perspectives into HIV prevention research. I often describe myself as a frustrated social psychologist because in psychology, the individual is a unit of analysis, and that's really informed so much of our prevention research. And so it's heartening to see the sort of shift towards more understanding how the larger context of men's lives may shape risk. There needs to be a focus on heterosexual black men. I am just absolutely flabbergasted by how little theory and research and interventions or just programs there are for this population. Women do not wear condoms. Men do. We know that the virus is much more efficiently transmitted, to use the CDC's language, from men to women, really underscoring the need for us to focus on black men. Black heterosexual men. And then finally, focusing on the strengths, you know, sort of the untold story. This is also something that we don't know so much about, and it's something that I really think would help us in our intervention efforts to learn about men who are not engaging in risk and learning how we can inform preventions and have them teach other men based on their strengths. I think that's it. Yep. You'll see me again soon. Thank you.